Hello, friends. There's lots of interesting things coming up in the Stoic Coffee community, so make sure that you sign up for my newsletter on my website at stoic.coffee. You can also follow me on Twitter at stoiccoffee and on Instagram at stoic.coffee, and you can find my LinkedIn page by searching for Stoic Coffee Break on LinkedIn. Now, I also wanted to let you know that I'm starting a mastermind for tech entrepreneurs as the world of tech is accelerating, and I've had people reaching out to me for a group grounded in Stoic principles. I'll be your facilitator as we tackle some of the big questions in tech using the tools of Stoicism. I have a few spots left for senior tech entrepreneurs and decision makers to join me for a one-hour bi-weekly session. I'll be interviewing candidates to form a tight group for the first cohort of five people, plus myself. Now, if you're interested in joining this, please reach out to me at masterminds@stoic.coffee. Now, again, that's masterminds@stoic.coffee. Thanks again, and thank you so much for listening to the podcast, and I appreciate your support. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Stoic Coffee Break. My name is Eric Cloward. On today's episode, we're doing something new. Today's episode is an interview with Jeff Emptman. He is the co-host of the podcast Here Be Monsters. Now, if you haven't listened to Here Be Monsters, it's kind of an unusual and strange podcast. It's about the mysterious, as Jeff likes to call it. Now, I met Jeff at Creative Live Podcast Week back in September, and he gave a presentation about story making and storytelling within a podcast format. And I found Jeff to be very thoughtful, very introspective, and just a very genuine and warm person. So I really thought he'd be an interesting person to interview on my podcast. So in this interview, we talk a bit about the challenges that Jeff has faced in his life. He had something handed to him that changed his career path for him when he was in college. And we also have a thoughtful discussion about philosophy and about how to apply philosophical principles and Stoic ideas in daily life. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. I hope you enjoy this interview with Jeff. And thanks again for listening. So today we're going to be talking with Jeff Emptman. He is the host and producer, co-producer on Here Be Monsters, which is really an interesting podcast. It's kind of beyond description. It's just one of those things you kind of have to listen to and just kind of be surprised. And some of you may love it. Some of you may kind of listen to it and go, oh my God, what the hell is this? But what's really neat about it is that each episode is something different and something interesting. So first, Jeff, go ahead and introduce yourself to the audience and tell us about what you're working on and anything you feel is important about you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you honestly did a pretty good job there, Eric, and I appreciate, you know, I appreciate that I'm not the only one who kind of gets a disclaimer when introducing the show, because it didn't take me very long after making the show to realize that there's a certain subset of people that really like it and a certain subset of people that really hate it, and that's fine, you know. When I started, I was trying to make a show that would be like the best show in the world for everyone, and I quickly realized that wasn't something I was actually capable of doing. So I appreciate that you've picked up on that too. I'm working on a couple things right now. Just wrapped up, just published this episode that I've been working on for a long time about, it was kind of about the Santeria faith, if you're familiar with Santeria, but it was more so about family and loss and tragedy. And that just came out on Wednesday. What date was that? We're recording on the 12th. So that was the 10th of October. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The project that's currently taking up my time is the next episode, which is going to be about this guy that I met who's building a nuclear fusion reactor out of parts that he's dumpster diving from MIT. So,
wow, that sounds scary and interesting.
You know, I've been learning a little bit about nuclear fusion, and it is dangerous, but significantly less so than fission. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can make it work, of course, he's still in proof of concept.
Yeah. Well, I lived in Utah during the time that Cold Fusion came out. There was a big hullabaloo about that. So
Cold Fusion came out. Cold Fusion doesn't exist yet, does it?
No, no. You should look it up. Back in the 80s, University of Utah, there were some professors who came out and said, yes, we have created Cold Fusion.
Mm.
And they published his results. There was a big hullabaloo about it. And then they went back and nobody could duplicate the results. And they kind of went, oh, well, you know, it sort of worked. We got these kind of sort of readings. And then, yeah, they were pretty much disgraced and lost all their funding.
Did you follow the stuff around the M drive out of Eagle Works at the JPL, NASA's? It's like NASA's experimental wing. And these researchers who are kind of like, what was that called? Like the New Earth Army, that like division of the United States military that was supposed to figure out if ESP was real. You know
no,
about this?
You know, this is all kind of new for me.
It was a John Ronson book that turned into the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Mm.
Did you ever see that?
Okay. I didn't. I was outside a theater one time where they had a giant cutout of George Clooney dressed in his outfit sitting at a table. So I have a picture of me staring at this cutout of George Clooney. Mm. Like he's staring at a goat. He's staring right at me. It was kind of amusing.
Yeah. So anyways, that kind of idea is like, there's these Hail Mary departments of the government that's like, there's no way this works, but just in case it does, like, we want to be the ones who figure out ESP, you know? And so like NASA has this kind of similar scenario where they have this lab called Eagle Works, where they just like throw a little bit of money to like these five-ish or so researchers who try and break the laws of physics. And they posted positive results here maybe 4 years ago or something, saying that they made an engine that doesn't exhaust anything. It doesn't push anything out, which really breaks the understanding of Newtonian physics. And the amount of force that it was generating was so, so small that to believe that the results of the paper were not just due to, I don't know, like someone walking down the hall, you know, shaking the floor ever so slightly, it involved a certain amount of, it was like a good litmus test for what kind of scientist you were, whether or not you trusted these results or not. And of course, it was something very hard to replicate that I don't think anyone has successfully done yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So I'm working on nuclear physics piece right now. Also, of course, a little bit about like Jungian thought and archetypes, and you know, it's always a mix of things. It's never just like a show about nuclear fusion or just a show about Santeria.
Excellent. So you said a little bit back there that when you first started out, you were trying to make a show to please everybody, and then you realized shortly that wasn't going to be the case. How did you move past that? What was it that you... How did you develop kind of that, I guess, thicker skin or that ability just kind of disconnect from that?
Well, I mean, doesn't everyone kind of wake up one day when they're young and be like, I think I have what it takes to be the greatest human being who's ever lived, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone has that thought for a day, right? Maybe for a minute or a moment. I had that thought for a little bit longer. I mean, I say that mostly as a joke, but like I thought that for a long time, that, you know, despite all of our differences in the world, that deep down, like secretly, everyone kind of thought of the world in the same way I did. And they either just didn't realize it or they didn't know it. You know, it's like it's a very self-interested kind of narcissistic thought to be like, I have the same thoughts as everyone else. Even though that seems very egalitarian. On one level, but I think it is kind of a form of narcissism or self-love to think that, you know, everyone else is just slightly different versions of you. And, you know, after making this show for a while and hearing some of the responses to it, I very quickly realized that actually a pretty small percentage of people think about things in the way I do, even so much in just like a very practical level, is sometimes I make music for the show and people are like, ooh, I like that creepy sound effect or like that creepy song. I was like, that wasn't supposed to be creepy. That was just supposed to be like thoughtful and reflective. But like, I've found that there's a decent percentage of the world that hears any kind of like deep bass note as creepy, you know? And that's just not how I experience the world. So that's like a more practical example of how I've noticed that. But on the much larger scale, like, yeah, like people are different. It's a stupid, simple observation, but it took me a really long time to get there.
Yeah, I think that we all kind of do that. And there's always that thought experiment, like kind of very strongly solipsistic, which is, you know, am I the only one who has thoughts in this world? And is everybody just a figment of my imagination? Mm-hmm. And as you get older, you know, it's still that whole thought experiment of this could be reality. But then you realize that it doesn't even matter if that's what reality is or not. There's all these other figments of your imagination, if you will. They're doing their own thing and liking their own things. So you have to learn to be okay with that. So but that's...
Was Descartes? Yeah, Descartes was the evil demon guy, right?
I heard there was a book that I was reading where they talked about Descartes and what kind of happened with him. From my understanding, is that he was a very strong philosopher, had came up with some great ideas and some mathematical ideas, and some of his probability theories were phenomenal. And then suddenly he got ultra religious and basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost went down this path of incredible self-loathing that humankind was just this lost, fallen thing.
Who's the modern Descartes then, Eric?
Oh, modern Descartes. Trying to think who I put in that. I tend to shy away from people like that. I grew up in a very religious community, so anything that even smacks of strong negative religion just really kind of makes me bristle, and so I just don't really listen to those kind of people anymore. I just found that oftentimes religion is too much of a cudgel to beat other people over the head, and to, you know, it's definitely a form of control. So for me, that's not something I really subscribe to. I think that you know, people are going to do what they're going to do, and the best thing you can do is try to urge them to do better things, to help them to do better things, but you can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do. And I think that's where a lot of our stress in this world comes from, is trying to control all those things that we can't.
I mean, that's kind of the let me tell you what Stoicism is about, Eric, on the show about Stoicism, which
Please
is a
do.
Topic I've studied only in the briefest forum, but when I've tried to describe Stoicism to people in a sentence before, what I've said is, you tell me if this is right or wrong. I've said, worry about the things that you can actually control, and don't worry about the things that you cannot control or influence.
Yep, I think that's kind of the core fundamental rule, and that's something that I struggle with a lot. So there are a lot of things in my life where I find that I get really angry about things and frustrated, and, you know, oftentimes lash out at things. And usually it's because it's something that I think I should have control over and I don't. And so I try to use that anger to control those things.
This might be something that you've talked about on the show that on an episode I haven't heard yet, but my critique of that thought has always been this, that I've noticed many points in my life when I've thought I couldn't do something, and then I realized I could. And it seems like I could hear a pretty valid critique of Stoicism being like, well, you're just kind of encouraging yourself to underestimate your potential for change in the world. Like, what do Stoics think about how you're supposed to accurately evaluate what you actually have control or influence over versus what you don't? Like, I don't think that anyone's running around saying I can prevent the heat death of the universe, but, you know, I might be able to convince 500 people to vote for a candidate, you know, something that seems outsized, like something that seems out of my control. Like, how do you determine what you can and can't control in Stoicism?
For me, the way that I've kind of broken it down is that what you can control is how you do something. It's the process of what you do. But when you try to control the outcome of what you do, that's where you run into trouble. So, for example, if you say, well, I'm only successful if I convince 500 people to go out and vote, then that's something that's outside of your control. Hmm. But if you say that I'm going to be successful by writing a good speech, booking a place where I'm going to give that speech, inviting as many people as I can possibly think of, and encouraging other people to invite their friends so that I can give this speech and hopefully I will influence a certain number of people. If you don't worry about the outcome, if you worry about the process and doing that really well and let the chips fall where they may, you've controlled what you can, which is how something gets done, but you can't control the outcome of it because there's so many factors and so many things outside of your control. I mean, it may rain that day. There may be a tornado that day. There could be a flood that day. So your great speech that you prepared for and did all these things for, maybe you only get 10 people to actually go out and vote. So it's focusing on the process. At least kind of that's how I've learned to think of it, is that it's process over outcome. And you need to do good work and let the chips fall where they may. And that's where you can really have a much better distinguishing line of this is something I control, this is something I can't control. At least that's my definition of it.
Yeah. I always wonder about that, about like, I mean, so these days, I've quit my day jobs currently, and I don't say permanently because, you know, that's a bad, way to do things. But a lot of my day jobs in the past have been jobs, and I do this intentionally, jobs where I can tell if I'm good at it or not, you know, because the problem with podcasting and all creative fields is that, I mean, I guess there's metrics on like the very strangest of levels, which is like with podcasts, you can like kind of tell how many people downloaded or listened to something, but it's like not good metrics. And of course, popularity isn't a sign that you're good at something. Whereas like one of my last jobs was working as a bike courier, and we had a computer system where I could occasionally go in and like view my reports, and I wasn't supposed to have access to this, but I could totally see it. I could compare my delivery times to other drivers. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm not the fastest, but I'm definitely not the slowest. I'm in like the top half of the heap, and I haven't been hit by a car ever. So I was like, oh, so like I can feel satisfied knowing that I'm actually good at this. Whereas, you know, at least in America, like a lot of those jobs are kind of disappearing to computers and outsourcing, right? And kind of what's left for a lot of people are these less tactile jobs that have like numbers associated with them. And I always have trouble feeling satisfied with my work because all I have is like the internal validation and like external validation from friends occasionally. Whereas I don't have those like numbers, you know, I can't be like, oh, I'm like in the like top, you know, whatever tier. But that it seems like the problem that I've always had with that is that it relies, like that kind of satisfaction relies on a feeling of superiority over other people. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very much a comparison to other people.
Right.
And that's where the Stoics are. So that, according to the Stoics, would be a clear example of something that you can't control. You can't control how good somebody else is at something you're doing. You can only control how good you are at something.
Oh, but with the bike thing, I could work harder and I could scoot my way up the ranks, right? Uh-huh. I could control that. Like if I had looked at that chart, because I wasn't like a great employee. I was like a decent employee, uh-huh. You know, like I didn't rob the company and I didn't do anything terrible to anyone, but I definitely could have worked harder. And if I had found out I was on the bottom of the heap, I probably would have worked harder just because I don't like being like having a number on me that, you know, I'm not sure if it's healthy or not. Like I can see, like, as I say it, it sounds like it's kind of unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I think that it can be, I think that some people do get wrapped up in comparison. I know that that was something that I struggled with as well in different aspects of my life. So I don't think you're unusual in that. I find as I get older, I just don't care as much. So, and I don't think it's necessarily an attitude of, well, I just don't care, but it's, I think that I'm getting to that place where, like I said, that where I focus on trying to do good work and I don't really care about the outcome of it. I mean, I do in an aspect, like on this podcast, for example, I do like looking at my numbers. I check them out probably every couple of days, and it's kind of nice to see, you know, the number of downloads going up, and, you know, I'm like, oh, I wish I could do these things. But what I recognize, so at the conference that I met you at with, you know, Tim Ferriss, when he gave me that advice, he's just like, work on mastering your craft. And that's really what it came down to, that that was the main thing that I could control, and that would drive things. And so I look at the numbers mostly just as an encouragement to, like, hey, yeah, people are actually digging this. This is really cool. And that's about all I can do, because there's nothing that I can do to push those numbers by any means. And I think Dan Meisner at the same conference gave a really big thing where he talked about numbers of things. And he goes, basically, this is what your podcast is probably going to look like. And it's just this long, slow growth. He goes, now, occasionally you're going to get this little hockey stick like I got right here. And that was where there was something where he'd been featured on some really, really well-known podcast. And they said, hey, this is one of my favorite podcasts, and got a shout out on that. And then, you know, he saw this sudden bump in his numbers, and it went up from there. But usually it's just going to be that slow growth like that. And that's something to, you know, again, I can't control how fast that grows. I mean, yes, I could go out and buy ads on Facebook and do those other things. But even then, you know, who knows how that's going to be. So I've just continued to do this because it's something that I'm growing from. Every time I have to dig into a topic and really think about these ideas, I internalize them a little bit more. And these are things that I really need to learn. So usually I'm writing about something that I'm really struggling with and going, oh my gosh, I suck at this. Or, you know, I had a fight with my partner about this and I'm really struggling with this thing. And so, I don't know, that's how I found to kind of move past those things.
Yeah. If you felt like you were making good work, but instead of a slow incline, you had a slow decline, would you change anything or no?
I think I might change some things if it was like my living and it was what I had to do. You know, it might be one of those things where it's like, okay, I'm going to write the music I want or do this thing that I want. And I'm also going to do this thing to please people. I mean, I think a lot of artists do that. They find that blend of doing things that pay the bills and doing things that, you know, feed their soul. And finding that balance it's hard. And I've struggled with that a lot. And like you said, you've quit your day jobs for now and just focusing solely on the podcast. And if your podcast number is starting to go down and maybe you lost some sponsorships, would you change things?
Well, see, I'm in a strange situation because I don't rely on download numbers for my living. I rely on yet again another like soft thing that is not based in metrics, which I struggle with, which is that I'm part of a larger radio station that pays me a flat amount every month.
Oh, nice.
Which in some regards is so nice because I don't spend every moment thinking about audience, and it frees me up to like try more experimental things. But at the same time, I don't get that direct feedback, or for that matter, that direct incentive to go out and write an email to every podcaster I know and be like, hey, can you do that Dan Meisner thing for me? Can you, like, what you just mentioned, you know, like, can you like reference me on your show and, you know, get those download numbers up? Because I'm not as motivated by fame as I once thought I was. I'm motivated by like having a house where I can feel at peace and like the ability to, you know, hit 10 o'clock at night and like start up my music software and drink a beer and like poke out some ideas, you know, or like, right now, like I'm trying to figure out how to 3D model Jell-O, you know, on the computer. And it's like, do these things have any impact on the actual world, I don't know, because like I'm kind of in this unicorn situation and I don't quite know how to feel about that, where I do work a lot. I work, you know, full time, but is it actually worth anything, you know?
I don't know. That's something that I think all of us have to figure out, is, you know, figuring out what is the thing that's going to fulfill us. And if we looked out, you know, that's another big Stoic thought, is look into the opinions of others. If we rely too much on the opinions of others, then we're relying on something that we don't have control over. And if our happiness is tied to that, then yeah, that can be very difficult. So I think learning to find that kind of inner peace, that inner tranquility, which is one of the biggest things of Stoicism, is finding that inner tranquility so that the opinions of others don't change our happiness. It's nice to have, but it's one of those, like, if somebody doesn't like what we're working on, okay, not a big deal. And it's sometimes easier to say than do. So yeah. I think you're in a pretty good spot on that. So one of the things that I remember from the conference that we talked about, you talked a bit about your eyes and how you had started off down one path for your career, and because of your vision, you ended up changing that. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. You know, I'd gone to school for photography. Mostly it was an interdisciplinary school, but I was mostly studying photography and I was looking to become a professional photographer. I had already started having some doubts about it as I got later into college and as I actually started meeting real professional photographers. And I, at the same time, was becoming more and more interested in sound. At the time, I thought that the secret plan was to eventually make movies. And the path towards that would be to focus on visual and then focus on sound and then try and combine the two together at some point down the line, some later point. I haven't thrown that out entirely, but I kind of had a situation handed to me from the universe that was out of my control, which is that it was like a couple days after I graduated college, I woke up one morning and I thought my contact prescription needed changing, because in my left eye, I started noticing like kind of a blurriness and like a halo around some things. It was very mild at first, but I went to a doctor pretty soon after that, and he sent me to a big city same day. Like, he sent me to this place like an hour and a half away the same day so that I could see someone same day. And then the next day, I stayed overnight at a hotel with my mom. And then the next day they told me that I had a kind of degenerative genetic retina condition that, well, it would be degenerative if it wasn't treated. And if it wasn't treated, I would eventually lose vision in my left eye. So they zapped me with a bunch of laser beams. And after a couple years of treatments and cataract surgery, I eventually have pretty stable vision in my left eye now. But throughout this period, I was kind of fluctuating between corrected, you know, 20/20 vision with my contacts in. Down at one point I was seeing like 20/150 out of my left eye. And it was it was like kind of this wild fluctuation. And at the same time I was like having these like very mild visual hallucinations and the world kind of looked like it was pinching in on itself. And it kind of killed slowly my deep interest that I once had in photography, and replaced it with that same deep interest in sound. And that's when I started making the podcast, was right after, it was about 6 months after I got that diagnosis. So the first season of shows was like pretty heavily influenced by not being able to see much out of my left eye.
Wow. And how did you feel internally about that? Were you scared or?
Well, it's a very rare condition, and I'm a very unusual case for it, because almost everyone that has it is either under 10 years old or has adult onset diabetes, and I'm neither of those two. So there's still some uncertainty about it, but at the time there was a lot of uncertainty about it because they weren't quite sure I'd been diagnosed right. And they were worried that it was going to happen to my right eye as well. And that could still happen at any point. My vision today out of my left eye is like, if I close my right eye, it's like good enough to walk around. It'd be good enough to do everything except read, probably. Everything's just a little bit blurry and a little, like, literally like a little bit twisted. Like there's a little twist to it, but it's enough to get around. It wasn't that way. It wasn't that way back then. I was fairly certain back then that I was going to lose my left eye, which would mean, you know, pretty significant change of lifestyle. Yeah, I ride my bike a lot, and it's very important to me to ride my bike. And I was like thinking about what that would mean for me to lose that as like my way of getting around. You know, I'd have to walk everywhere or take the bus or hire someone to drive me or marry someone who could drive me or marry. what I was really looking for was like a life partner that would be like down to ride front seat of a tandem. I don't think I've ever told anyone that before.
No, that's great. That's totally great.
Because I was very convinced I was going to lose my vision. I got really lucky. I had good doctors. But I do often wonder, you know, like had the situation happened differently and I did, you know, lose my vision in my left eye, what kind of change I would make. And, you know, my show is distributed by KCRW, and there's another really great show from KCRW called The Organist, which on its surface is kind of a literary show, but it's not really a literary show. It's like a show about the world. And I love the host of that show, Andrew Leland. And he and I, during kind of the height of my it's kind of weird to say this, but like the height of my vision loss, he and I kind of bonded over this false pretense where I kind of told him I was going to lose an eye's vision. And we kind of bonded over this because he has a degenerative retinal condition. And he is very slowly going from full vision down to pinpricks, losing his peripheral just, you know, a day at a time. And he's been doing this process for the last 10 or 15, maybe 20 years or so. Wow. And he's just crossed the threshold of legal blindness in the state of Massachusetts. And so he's doing Braille training and, you know, starting to use his cane more often and whatnot. And, he can still see out of the center of his vision, you know, but, you know, pretty impactful kind of vision loss. And a lot of his show recently, he's been doing these really great monologues at the front talking about that transition to blindness and really changing my perspective on something I thought I had thought a lot about, you know. I'm not sure if his thoughts would be considered stoic thoughts, but they're thoughts that remind me that, you know, life is more than seeing things. Because I've definitely had that thought before, that my life would be ruined if I lost half of my vision. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've lost about a tenth of it, you know?
Yeah. Wow. That's, yeah, my vision is really good. I have reading glasses that I have to use every now and then. But lately my vision has been, it kind of goes in and out. And so it's been really good lately. So while I cannot even closely relate to what you guys are talking about, I think that's pretty amazing. So do you think that the, your eye condition has changed kind of your relationship with sound then.
Yeah. When I made the transition fully from when I made the transition from photo to audio, I felt a little behind because I'd spent so much of my time focused on this one way of perceiving the world. Mm-hmm. And so what I did when my vision started going is I started saying, well, okay, like I had this big focus on dusk and dawn in my photography work. I've learned a lot about these time periods in the day and also like the concepts that go around them, the thought process that I have around these times of day, the characters, you know, the animals that show up, the way light hits objects. And I tried my best to translate all of that knowledge into audio as well. And so the aesthetic of the show is really the aesthetic of my photography, but translated into an audio format. Of course, not everything translates, but I took as much of it as I could and tried to expand upon it as much as I could in the sound world. So especially in my early work, God, there's like crickets everywhere in it. Like everything is crickets. And I have kind of a nostalgia for that sound. I don't really use them much anymore, but that's like a very obvious way of doing it. There's more, softer conceptual things that I also took from my photography, and brought with me.
I like that. I like that idea of taking your perspective from one sense and then trying to adopt that perspective, you know, with a different sense and seeing how you can kind of apply those. That's really interesting. I remember there was one thing you said at the conference that really just, you know, as you were talking, that really just floored me. And it was that as you were losing your vision, you talked about how you were seeing these hallucinations, these weird things happening. And you're like, what I learned is that I can't trust my senses. You don't believe everything you see and that your eyes will lie to you. And I thought that was very kind of a profound thing that, you know, we think that we see the world in a certain way, or we think that we see reality for what it really is. And just something as small as a little, you know, a little flaw in the eye can change what your reality is. I mean, if that had happened to you, if you saw, like you said, it almost seemed like there was a black hole going on there. You know, if you didn't know what that was, you'd almost think that reality was turning into a black hole.
You know, for a while, I would occasionally do this little exercise with myself where I would cover up my right eye, so my good eye, and I would just leave myself with my left eye, my bad eye, or is what I more euphemistically called my magic eye, right? Because mm-hmm. My magic eye would like kind of twist and distort the world and pinch it in around the center, and there's a dead spot in the middle that would sometimes have this color floating around in it that was both green and black at the same time. It was this impossible color of green and black and like fluorescent. It was like glowing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was a result of these laser treatments that I was getting. And it was like the after image in my retina, essentially. So I'd like walk around the house, and it's like, again, my vision was bad, but it wasn't, you know, like I could stumble around. I could move around, and I knew kind of how my house was. So I could like get around and I would just, you know, just even after like 5 or 10 minutes of having my good vision obscured, I would start to get used to it, you know? And I've never been good at putting this in words, but like when the world is blurry, my brain would just adjust to it at a certain point. Mm. And like things that seem very obvious with like when I had my good eye open just weren't noticeable. And so it was this incredible rush to like do that for 5 or 10 minutes and like look at the wall or look at, like, I had this like wooden like mantle over the fireplace and like wooden backdrop back there at the time, and just looking and be like, wow, that's some like beautiful woodwork there. And then take my other hand off of my eye and be like, oh my God, there's like detail in the grain. There's like these knots in the wood. There's these cracks. There's like a cobweb up at the ceiling, like all this stuff that, you know, it felt like I had like supervision for a second when instead I had like normal vision, you know, like 20/20 vision. It felt like supervision for a minute, you know. And one thing I try to remember, I mean, I always used to think about hawks as a kid, you know, the hawk with the incredible vision, because we had hawks where I grew up, like red-tailed hawks. And, you know, they can see a mouse running from whatever, like 50 feet up in the air. You know, they can see a mouse scooting around on the ground. And that, like, us humans that think we have good vision or good any sense, you know, it's just like if you know, it's an incredibly a matter of perspective, because compared to the hawk, the best human vision is still shit, you know. Mm-hmm. just varying levels of bad. There's a lot of perspective there. I hear it in sound sometimes too, when a mixing engineer, I hear it a lot in independent movies, when a mixing engineer forgets that wireless lav mics make really high-pitched tones. And I've got pretty good high-pitch hearing. And so a lot of times in independent movies, you'll just hear like this meep, meep, like little mosquito sounds as it cuts to someone using a wireless lav. Because these older mix engineers, usually older mix engineers, have damaged hearing or just naturally degrading hearing that prevents them from hearing those highest of pitches. And they just never let someone under the age of 30 listen to their project before it goes live. And there's just these things that are entirely invisible to them that act as kind of a tell, a way of knowing something that the movie maker didn't want you to know about the movie.
Interesting.
Just that there were no young people in the room.
No, that's fascinating. The Stoics are huge on the idea of perception is always opinion. What you perceive is never fact, but it's always just your opinion of the world. And because we can't ever know a purely objective reality, we can only know our perspective of reality. And that's interesting listening to it. I really like that idea of having, you know, this is my magic vision and this is my supervision. And I think having that contrast can really help you appreciate, you know, the vision that you do have. But also, I like the fact that you appreciated what you also had. You know, you appreciated the magic, that it was this interesting way of viewing the world. And I think this has been really interesting. I love the fact that you took something that could have been so discouraging, so damaging, and rather than letting it, you know, sink your world, you're like, well, okay, audio looks interesting. Let's move over there. And basically you know, the Stoics have a thing where they talk about the obstacle is the way, that the troubling things that come up in our lives, the challenging things in our lives that come up in our lives, are the things, by going through them, by working through these, they are the way that we get stronger, and they are the way that we move towards the good things in our life. And to me, I just from my perspective, I see how you took this one thing that other people would have been like, oh my gosh, my world is over. This is the end of it. And you went, okay, well, this changes things, and let's see where this goes. And so far, I think it's worked out pretty well for you. At least if you want my humble opinion, an outside opinion, I really enjoy your podcast. The mood, the vibe of it is, it's very haunting. It's very visceral. And for me, you know, I like those unusual things. I like those things that kind of keep you guessing on your feet. The one episode that I first listened to was the one about the video game and the canoeing trip, and the weird kind of transition between those two of just moving from one right to the other without saying I'm in this one or that one, was a little bit disorienting at first, but it was also really cool because, you know, suddenly you talk about praying to my God, and I think it was like Baylor or Bejor or something like that. And it just, I'm like, Whoa, where, what? Where did the, oh, okay, he's, that's where that's coming from, man. It's kind of like, my brain was just kind of like, had to scramble for a minute there to figure out what you were talking about. Then it was like, oh, okay, like Dungeons and Dragons, you have, okay, that kind of thing. And, yeah, so then also the other one that really touched me was the woman from, I think it was Norway, talking about her father and growing up and trying to understand that situation. You know, just these really touching stories that are very, also very mysterious and very haunting at the same time. And I don't know. I think you're doing something great, and I think you should definitely keep doing what you're doing. At least I really enjoy what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Eric. I really appreciate that. You know, those are more recent episodes, and I still feel like I'm getting better at this. This is the thing I'm terrified of, you know, not so much the numbers going down, but like the day when I wake up and I'm like, oh God, like I used to be better at this, you know, that's what I'm scared of. And that will probably happen at some point. But, these recent episodes I've been challenging myself on a lot, and I'm glad that some of that has come through to you as a listener.
Oh, for sure. But I also like your very first episode. I listened to that and I laughed out loud. I was walking through New Seasons, which is like kind of a Whole Foods here locally. Mm-hmm. And when you talked about dragging Maine, I did a loud snort because I lived in a small town once for a year, my freshman year in high school in southern Utah. And they had one flashing red light to show you to slow down at the one intersection that was the crossroads. And when I first moved down there, I'd been living out in the Metro DC area. So, you know, we've got several million people packed in, you know, very tight spaces and so on. I mean, it was huge living out there, you know, millions and millions of people, then going down to 1200 people in the middle of the desert. It was very shocking. And then what they did was they would drag Maine. And I'm like, why would you do that? That's so boring. And they're like, well, there's nothing else to do. And it was just like, it was just a very strange feeling. So when you said that, I just, as you were leading up to it, this is what they do. And I just started laughing right as you said, dragging Maine.
You probably have to put a like asterisk in there for all of your metropolitan listeners who have never heard that phrase before.
Yeah. Yeah, and
little,
it's
like a little audio asterisk of dragging Maine, like cross-reference that in the Webster's, you know?
Yep, and in this town, basically Main Street was about a mile long for the, you know, the borders of the town, and so they just drive down one side and drive down the other. And
just see what people are doing.
Yeah, and the thing is halftime there wasn't really people doing much of anything. Mm-hmm. It was just they didn't have anything else to do.
And yeah, well, so the dogs might be doing something, you know. Sometimes the dogs are doing interesting things. You can watch them.
Yeah, it was a really interesting thing, and it certainly made me laugh.
Yeah. Just one last thing. Like, I grew up outside of my town in the country, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's this one guy who would walk on the gravel road. He would walk each morning for exercise, you know, and he had a dog. And the dogs were all bored. And so they would all just tag along in the mornings. And so he would go around each morning and essentially, I mean, he didn't have to do anything. They just showed up. He would essentially like pick up each dog at the end of its driveway and walk with it for a while. And then he would turn around and walk home and each dog would just run back up its own driveway, you know, back to where it lived. But he would walk every dog in the I can't call it a neighborhood, but like in the mile long stretch between his house and mine.
Wow.
So yeah, our dog would sometimes just run out there to the end of the road, and he was essentially dragging Maine, but it wasn't Main Street, it was just a gravel road.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, dogs are very social too. They want to be able to do something, so very cool. Well, Jeff, I know that we're getting close on time here, so
yeah.
I think we'll go ahead and wrap up here. But hey, I just want to say I really appreciate this. Like I said, this is my very first interview, so I'm not sure when this is going to be out, but
Send me a link, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I'll keep listening, too. I've been enjoying the recent episodes.
No, I appreciate it. So it's definitely a stretch for me. Like you said, you're always challenging yourself. It's definitely a stretch for me to take these ideas and kind of pull the meat out of them as best I can, and not just, you know, give a surface, hey, here's a quote and, you know, have a nice day. It's kind of like, well, here's a quote and here's kind of the deeper stuff in it. And it, when I'm writing, I'll sometimes find that little thing where it's like, oh, there's that nugget that I want. And it's that little bit of discovery that keeps driving me. Just like how you were talking about challenging yourself, you know, with these different things. And who knows? We'll see where the show goes. But I appreciate you being my first guest. And thanks again.
Absolutely. Anytime, Eric.
Hey, friends. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you like what you hear, I would really appreciate if you could help support me by making a pledge on Patreon. You can find me at patreon.com/stoiccoffee. Even just a small amount helps in keeping this podcast going. Also, head on over to my website at www.stoic.coffee and sign up for our weekly newsletter. And lastly, if you know someone that might like or could benefit from this podcast, please share it with them. Word of mouth is one of the best ways to help this podcast grow. Thanks again for listening.